Tonight on Banfield, day 16 of the Idaho quadruple murder mystery and a bombshell admission from police. If you thought they must have a suspect or at least a person of interest that they just haven't told us about, think again. And if you thought this bloodbath was connected to drugs and dealing, wrong again. Also tonight, a mystery inside the mystery. Where exactly did Zanna and Ethan go on their last night alive? 4 hours and 45 minutes are unaccounted for, yet somehow police haven't really mentioned it. And then, when no one is a suspect, everyone's suspected. And some are eviscerated online and in public just for the crime of knowing the victims or living nearby. You'll meet one of them tonight. And later, we want to know what you want to know. Our Brian Enten is still on the case and fielding your questions. And it is all straight ahead in this special hour of Banfield. Hello and welcome to a special hour, the coverage of the University of Idaho murders for 2 weeks and 2 days. The brutal slaying of Ethan Chapin, Madison Mogan, Zanna Kernodle, and Kaylee Gonsalves has gone unsolved. Their killer unpunished and still on the loose. And while the police have not named any suspects, let alone made any arrests, they have implored the community to trust them. To trust that they know more than they are telling us. But tonight, we know on the record what the investigators don't know. They haven't publicly named any suspects or persons of interest because they simply do not have any. And they said as much to News Nation today, the same day that they finally removed the victims' vehicles from the house on King Road and the surviving roommates' vehicles as well, towing them to a more secure location where they can process evidence. We also learned today that the private party that drove Maddie and Kaylee home from this area, the grub truck, where they had stopped after being at a bar that night, that private party was actually a sorority-designated driver service. Kaylee's father shared that information with ABC News. Again, this is day 16, and it doesn't feel a whole lot different than day one. Our senior national correspondent, Brian Enten, is our eyes and our ears in Moscow, Idaho. He is live there tonight, and he joins me now with everything that he's learned. And today, you learned a lot because you spoke to a lot of people. So, Brian, let me start with this. You got a chance to talk to the prosecutor who's actually going to handle this case, Bill Thompson. And I get it. Investigations are sensitive. You can't always talk about them. They seem to be tight-lipped, but I'm really wondering if they're tight-lipped or if they really just don't have a clue.
Yeah, that's what everyone has been wondering, Ashley, especially the people who live in this town. They've been wondering themselves, is it possible that behind the scenes, police have all this information, that they're very, very close, that we should feel better about all of this? And unfortunately, we basically learned the opposite today when we sat down with the prosecutor here in Moscow. Listen to what he told us.
Are there persons of interest and people that the investigators are looking at?
I think it's fair to say that there have been people of interest to the investigators, and everyone that they've identified so far, they've been able to exonerate. Perhaps exonerate isn't the best word, but they've been able to eliminate them as being an actual suspect. And we do not have a name of a person or persons who are actual suspects. That's what they're focusing on still.
So there's not someone behind the scenes that you secretly know about that you're just waiting on one more piece of evidence or one more piece of DNA? And then, boom, this will be settled.
I can tell you that I'm not aware of any single person with a name that we're focusing on, that the investigators are focusing on.
Okay. So it could be a while.
It could be. Or it could break open any time.
It was certainly interesting to hear that, Ashley. I asked him a couple more times after just to make sure. I said, so this isn't like investigative technique That you're not releasing information? And he said, no, not to my knowledge. I'm the prosecutor. I meet with the detectives every day, and we don't have a suspect. We haven't seen a suspect on surveillance video. We've ruled people out, but there is no person of interest right now.
So I'm just going to make a note of what I just saw behind you. A person walked behind you during your live report, and it dawned on me that the crime tape is gone from behind you. It is now, it looks to me like it's right up against the house. They've actually, they've done a shrink on the crime scene. Is that, am I seeing it right?
So no, it's up, Ashley. It's just low. We'll zoom out a little bit and show you. It's just a little bit lower. There's been a lot of action out here today. You can see the crime scene tape right there. They've been in and out all day, so things have moved around. You showed how the cars were all towed away today. Now there's just this police cruiser behind me. So they moved the crime scene tape around a little bit when they were towing all the cars out.
All right, that makes sense. I did wonder if since they moved those cars, that's no longer part of the crime scene, but clearly it still is. So let me get to the other big break of the day, because honestly, Brian, if you are following this case, especially online, so many people have said this was such a brutal stabbing murder, so gangland style, that perhaps there was some kind of drug activity or drug connection, and you got a definitive answer on that today.
Yeah, I asked the prosecutor about that, and he said, to his knowledge, drugs are not involved. I tried to ask him, you know, you and I were on the phone last night going over all these theories for hours, and I tried to get to almost all of them. He said, I asked him about whether or not inside the house the killer left any messages, anything on the walls. He said, no, not to his knowledge, but the drugs was a big one. He addressed that. Listen to what he told me.
Could drugs be involved in all of this?
I have not heard that there's any suspicion that drugs played a role in the killings.
No. So not like a drug deal gone bad or something like that?
I am not aware of anything like that, no.
And that's obviously important, Ashley, because if you look online... Oh, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. Yep.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's a big one, because there's all sorts of theories online that there may have been drugs involved, but he said right there, no, that's not the case.
Which it leaves us even in more confounded, because, again, with that violent style of murder, angry, almost retributive, it's now leaving us to all the other possibilities of why someone might not have done that if it weren't to avenge, you know, a drug deal or a drug turf or something like that. So the other question I had, when we saw those cars being towed, and I don't know if we can roll some of that video, I was curious about it being day 16. I would have thought that those vehicles might have actually had some clues in their inner mechanisms. The GPS locator sometimes can tell you where cars have been, where cars have driven. But 16 days later, they could not have processed that on the scene, and now here they are towing them away. And also, they're towing them away in an unusual way. You can see that the front wheels are on another set of wheels. I don't know if you know whether that's to stop the jostling of the evidence that might still be in the vehicle. Did they say anything about that?
They had a couple of different tow trucks out there. I don't think they towed them all that way, so I don't know that's the reason. But we asked police why today, and basically they just said it was now time to move them to a secure facility where they would do further crime scene processing of the cars. I got to tell you, overall, the feeling I got today after these interviews with police and the prosecutor is, if there's no person of interest and, you know, I mean, they're making some progress, but it seems like now they're going back and really examining some of these other items, including the cars.
Well, I mean, then let's hope that they're going to have an opportunity to get into some kind of evidence that might exist within those vehicles, even if it's the electronic evidence that will show where the vehicles might have been, if that yields any clues. So slowly, it appears that they may be moving towards eventually releasing that crime scene. And I've always wondered whether they were going to hold that crime scene indefinitely until they caught someone and prosecuted someone, just like Stoneman Douglas. The high school was held like a vault, like a museum, for years and years, so that the jury could actually go there and see it exactly as it was when the shootings happened. Is that going to happen with this house?
I don't think so. And I asked the prosecutor that question. It doesn't sound like they plan to hold it like this indefinitely until there's possibly a trial. If they catch the killer, hopefully they will. But he did tell me they're in no rush to clear it. He said what he told the police and the detectives is he feels that they should keep this a crime scene as long as they feel they need to until they have looked at every single possible little thing. And again, finding out today that there is no person of interest and there is no suspect behind the scenes that they know about, it seems that they're going to keep it this way for a while because there's a lot more investigating to do.
Yeah, there was some talk that they might be actually releasing that house soon. And I just wonder if that's actually going to happen. Don't forget, there's two survivors. Presumably, they were taken from that house instantly without all of their possessions. And then, of course, those families of the victims would probably want to get some of the possessions of their children back at some point. So that's it's a morbid thought, but it's also important for some of those families. Just to the investigation inside the house, I know that you saw them back in there yesterday. I don't know if they were back in there again today or tonight or if the lights are on, but they were dusting for prints yesterday. And yesterday was day 15. And I just sort of wondered, like, why? Why so late? Was there something particular or special or different about yesterday?
Not that we know of. I didn't see them go back in the house today. We had that video of them going inside briefly yesterday. And even though the prosecutor and the police said that there's no known suspect, they were very clear that even though there's not a suspect, the investigation is progressing. There are still, you know, dozens of FBI agents working on the case. So there's a lot happening behind the scenes and they are constantly ruling people out. So it doesn't surprise me that we're still seeing a lot of action at the house.
All right. So I want to move to the issue of the word targeted. I know people are frustrated by that word. Early in this entire ordeal, they said nothing to see here. My words. It's a targeted attack. And then they walked it back slightly. But now they have maintained over and over targeted, targeted, targeted. No sexual assault, no robbery. But today you were able to sort of drill down a little more on the word targeted and if there's any significance to it. What did they say?
Yeah, that was something we obviously had to ask about because the victims' families have been frustrated by the word targeted and the community and the students here have brought it up over and over again, not really knowing what it means. And we don't even really know what it means because it's like they just used the word targeted early on and never really explained it. And it seems like even now they're sort of walking it back a little bit. Listen to what the prosecutor had to say about that.
One thing that we've been told is that this was targeted. That's one word that's come up, targeted. Can you shed any more light on that? Because even with the students and some of the victims' families, they've almost been frustrated by that, not really knowing what that means.
It seems like the word targeted has had different different understandings for different people who are listening and perhaps isn't the best word to use. The bottom line is whoever's responsible for this is still at large. That can't be changed. My understanding is the investigators believe that whoever's responsible was specifically looking at this particular residence, but that's all that they can offer at this point.
Can they say whether they were looking at a particular, whether the person responsible was looking at a particular individual?
I don't think they can say that at this point. They are still, that's part of the investigation, is trying to determine who might have been the target.
So still so much we don't know. It's still confusing. If there's no suspect they know of, he told me he's never seen surveillance video of a suspect, then how do they know that this house behind me was targeted? Still so many missing gaps, Ashley.
So tomorrow, a vigil is planned for these four kids. And obviously, all the kids are back now from Thanksgiving break. I'm assuming a lot of people are going to go. But do the police, have they let on that they're going to be really carefully watching who comes to that vigil? Because I have covered enough cases in the past where killers return to funerals and vigils and celebrations, etc. Are they going to have like behavioral analysts watching that crowd?
That's a really interesting question. And they weren't going to get into that with me today when I interviewed police. I asked about that. I asked, are you concerned the killer could show up to the vigil? Because again, that's something we hear over and over again from students. They said, we have heard that concern. We have plans in place. Our detectives have plans in place. So you're probably right. They could have people there. They're expecting 6 more inches of snow tomorrow. So the latest I've heard is that the vigil is likely going to be moved indoors on the university campus. Mm. But I would imagine there's going to be undercovers there keeping an eye on things.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the snow, because coming up in a little bit, I have a big question for you regarding the snow, and it pertains to this case and clues. Brian, hold for 1 second, but don't go anywhere, because I want to bring Gemma Gaudette into our conversation. Gemma is the host of Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio. So, Gemma, I get it. Moscow is a small town. But the state police and the FBI are there as well. And we're at 16 days. And, you know, in my line of work, that's a long long time to be processing a crime scene, but you're from there. You know Idaho. Am I jumping the gun here at thinking it's too long, or is it, you know, par for the course by Idaho standards?
You know, Ashley, I don't think it's par for the course. I mean, I think the issue is that we don't see crimes like this happen in Idaho often, nor do, frankly, we see crimes like this happen often, right? So I think that when it did happen, Moscow Police Department is small. They don't see murders even once a year. So as trained as you can be in law enforcement, I think something like this can catch you off guard and flat-footed. And I think maybe that's potentially what happened. And now there's this catch-up that is going on, if that makes sense. And right. So we do know, too, that Idaho State Patrol is wanting anyone that has maybe video that's been in the home, right? Because we know that the two surviving roommates were not the only ones in the home. So they are wanting more information. So I think it is, they are doing everything that they can, but did they maybe not do enough in the very beginning? Potentially,
yeah.
But
or underestimate how big, you know, the job was going to be. I'll say this, Gemma, yeah. and Brian knows this because he's also covered his fair share of cases like this. But if you think about that house and the amount of evidence that would be in it, who knows when the last time it was really thoroughly cleaned? So how many hairs, fibers, pieces of sweater, animal, dander, fingerprints, blood droplets that have nothing to do with maybe what happened 16 days ago. How many pieces of evidence, let alone sources of DNA, might actually be in there? And Gemma, to that, I get it. That will take a lot of time to collect. But it would also indicate to me that 113 pieces of evidence, which is what they said last week they'd collected, is not even close to being enough. Have we got an update on that? Are we expecting an update on that? Will there be a larger number? I thought it was going to be over 1,000 pieces of evidence, you know, collected from the house.
Again, Ashley, I think that they are holding certain things close to the vest, law enforcement is. You're absolutely right that there's got to be more than 113 pieces of evidence. Are they giving us any information? No. We are asking, and we continue to get, you know, the same information, is that when they have information, they will give it to us. And that is frustrating. And I think that that's not just frustrating for journalists. I think that's frustrating for the survivors, for the families. I mean, we all know that Kaylee's father gave his first interview nationally. And he even said he's frustrated because law enforcement isn't being transparent. Yet at the same time, he has to also believe that they are doing everything they can to find the person who did this.
Yeah. Brian, 20 seconds real quickly, that just dovetail on what Gemma just said about the frustration among the families. But what about the kids who are all there, the community that lives there, the locals who can't just go home if it's, you know, a scary place to be? Are they frustrated? Are they hopeful? Do they have any sense that this is going to be a long road?
I mean, look, unless they catch a killer, until they catch the killer, everyone's going to be frustrated. That's just the way it goes. People aren't going to feel safe. They're not going to be happy. They're going to be critical of the police. I will say this, meeting with the police, meeting with the prosecutor today, I got the sense that they are working almost around the clock. You've got the FBI very much involved. So this isn't just a local police department handling this. And they are determined to get this thing solved. But again, unfortunately, it sounds like they've got a long way to go.
Boy, I'll say. And they worked through Thanksgiving Day as well. Gemma Gaudette, my great thanks to you for working with us on this case every night. We really appreciate it. Brian, I'm going to ask you to stick around if you would, because after the break, when the timeline goes dark, a mysterious four-hour block where two of the Idaho College kids just vanish off the radar. Where were Zanna and Ethan between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m.? Police don't seem to know. So why aren't they asking for more help in finding out? And could this be the key to the case? That's next. Welcome back. When it comes to murder investigations, every second counts. And that's why it's so shocking to learn that there could have been a long and mysterious gap in the movements of two of the victims, a gap that is almost 5 hours long and one that police can't or won't explain. Here's what I'm talking about. The Moscow police released a timeline for us on a map, and it shows where all four victims were on November 12th and 13th, right before they were murdered. And it also shows the times that they changed locations that night. And we've updated the map with the latest information provided by the police. But as you can see, Kaylee and Maddie were at the Corner Club from 10 p.m. till 1:30 a.m. And then they were at the Grub Truck at 1:40 a.m. before returning home at 1:56 a.m. So that's all pretty clear. Ethan and Zanna's movements are a lot less detailed. The map shows them at the Sigma Chi fraternity party from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. And then it just jumps ahead by 4 hours and 45 minutes and shows them coming home at 1:45 a.m. And that means that we just don't know where Ethan and Zanna were for nearly 5 hours on that Saturday night before they died. It would seem that that information would be critical to the investigation, and yet there's really been no mention by the police for the public to help them determine where Ethan and Zanna were during that five-hour gap in time. Could they have gone somewhere or met up with somebody who was connected to their deaths? And if the police don't know, shouldn't they be specifically appealing for people to help them fill in the critical blanks about Ethan and Zanna's whereabouts? For more clarity on this, I want to bring Brian Enten back in. And Brian, you have worked, or you have walked from not far from where you are, the Sigma Chi house, to the house behind you. So, I mean, is it a long walk? Is it a quick drive? Like, give me a sense for how far away that would have been.
It's a very, very short distance, Ashley. The drive is maybe 3 to 5 minutes. If you put it in your phone GPS, it'll tell you it would take about 10 minutes to walk. But let me show you this. This is the house where the victims lived. And if you drove, you'd have to go down this road, which kind of winds around. But if you walk, which is what the kids here do, you can see right here, there's this little walkway that cuts down the embankment and goes all the way down to the main drag. So you don't have to zigzag around on the road. You cut right across. The frat house is right over there on the other side of that hill. So it's a very, very short walk. It's very easy to get to. And you mentioned it, there's that gap in the timeline. Police today acknowledging that they're still trying to get information about what was going on during that gap. Listen to what the police told me.
The timeline has obviously been key. You've released some details, but there's a hole with Zanna and Ethan. It says that they left the frat party at 9 p.m. but didn't get back to the house until almost 2 a.m. Yeah. Do we know where they were during that hole?
So I'm not sure that it says that they left the location. I believe it says that they were seen there. I think that's what it says, but we do want to figure out what occurred between the 9 and the 145, figure out who they were with, what that was going on, maybe any routes or paths that they took to end up going home, those types of things. Potentially, that is critical to the investigation. We don't know. So as students come back and they maybe had seen or been at the location with them or had seen them traveling through campus, we want to talk to those people. That's important to us.
Well, I mean, it's good to know that now, but no one has ever made a public appeal for this information about Ethan and Zanna in that 4 hour and 45 minute gap. And here's the other thing that really doesn't sit well with me, Brian. Ethan is a member of Sigma Chi. He's a brother at that fraternity. And so for someone to say last time they were seen was 9 p.m., if they were at that party for the next 5 hours, somebody would know that. I mean, someone would know. It's his fraternity. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you would think, and you could go to the fraternity. I assume they have surveillance cameras outside. They could interview the members who were there. It certainly is strange that there is that gap there. And you heard the police again today saying they want people to come forward and tell them if they saw the two during that time.
All right, don't go anywhere, because I do have a lot of other questions for you, Brian, as well as viewer questions on that issue about the weather and why that's really, really important. But in the interim, I want to do a quick deep dive on the significance of the gap in the timeline and why police may not want it to be the focus of the public. So for that, I want to bring in Ken Maines. He's a former detective and undercover FBI operative and has a reputation for helping solve unsolvable cases. Ken, weigh in on that. Why have the police not been screaming from the rooftops from day one? There's nearly 5 hours where we don't know the movements of Ethan and Zanna. Public, do your thing. Instead, it's just Brian asking them.
Yeah, I mean, I think any timeline, any crime, a timeline is imperative. In a homicide case, it's twofold, right? So why they're not asking for more information, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that, and I don't want to assume. But I am sure that they are looking into that, because it is of the utmost importance to figuring out what happened here.
So what are your thoughts about that? Would there be a reason, though, that they would just kind of brush that under the rug and, you know, release it only in a little square on a map where a lot of us thought they were at the frat party the whole time? Would there be a reason where they'd not want to, you know, scream for all the video and all the information and all the tips on Zanna and Ethan's whereabouts?
No, I don't think. I think it is just what it is, and that is they don't know. And if you don't know, I mean, you obviously can't put anything out other than that. And I think that's the case. And I think that's the case with this whole mystery, is they really just don't know.
Yeah. Ken, weigh in with your expertise. You know the violent and vicious nature of these killings, right? They were very, very good at what they did, whoever this killer was. All of the punctures were could have been lethal in themselves, according to the coroner, all in the upper body. All four died. Nobody survived this knife attack. Does this scream revenge? Does it scream obsession? Does it scream something else to you?
No. That's the thing, is you can't tell just based on injuries if something is personal. There are so many variables. A homicide is so fluid. It could have been that it was the very first person that the offender attacked when he went in. So he was fresh. He had more vigor. And maybe that's why that person got more stab wounds than the other. So you can't say, well, it's personal. You just can't say that. You can't tell that by stab wounds or wounds in general.
It is more mystifying today than I think it was when I started covering this. But Ken, I hope you'll come back on the program.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Thank you. Ken Maines joining us tonight. And still to come, cyber detectives can often spot the clues that real detectives miss, and they can and do break cases, but they can also ruin the lives of people they publicly and wrongly suspect. After the break, the dangers of crowd solving. Meet the man who says he had nothing to do with the Idaho murders, and yet he's been convicted online. He joins me live next. When Lauren Giddings went missing in Macon, Georgia 11 years ago, local reporters interviewed her neighbors. And one of those neighbors was a man named Stephen McDaniel. But McDaniel wasn't just a neighbor. He was also the killer who had dismembered Lauren and scattered her remains in dumpsters so that nobody would ever find her. Pay close attention, though, as the reporter asks him questions about the case and then reveals to him that part of a body has just been found.
Yeah, Lauren was my neighbor. We're just trying to find out where she is at this point. I mean, no one has seen her since Saturday. I mean, the last time anyone heard from her was an email that she sent out, and I mean, no one's heard from her since.
What about in the like the parking lot area? I know they've been doing a lot of, I think that's where they have recovered the body or whatever they recovered from there.
Body?
Had you heard any, had you seen anything there? Had you seen anything there? I mean, we don't know if this is the same person. You know what I mean? Like, they took out a body there earlier. We don't know if it's the same person or not. So that's how we're trying to ask people if they know who lived there. Are you okay, sir?
I think I need to sit down.
Boy, did he ever need to sit down. Eventually, after he sat down, McDaniel was caught. He was convicted. He was jailed. And crime buffs often refer to McDaniel's case when any neighbor is interviewed after a crime. My next guest says he never even heard of Stephen McDaniel or Lauren Giddings until a couple days ago when cyber-hungry sleuths in Idaho were suddenly comparing him to McDaniel. He lives in the area. Jeremy Reagan is a third-year law student, actually lives next door to the now infamous home where the kids were killed. He did some press interviews about the house and the loud parties there and the police comings and goings. And soon, Jeremy became internet famous, as he calls it, and was being accused of being the murderer himself. Let me just read a couple of tweets that people wrote about Jeremy online. So, has anybody thought about this Jeremy Reagan to be the killer of the four victims in Moscow, Idaho? Everybody needs to look him up. He won't give his DNA to the police officers, and he knows too much about the girls and the layout of the house and who's really in it. And this next tweet says, he's also a lawyer, learning how to be a lawyer. Who's that sound like? The lawyer Ted Bundy going around killing people? He also doesn't have any preference of who kills, but he knew who he wanted to kill. Somebody better be going and looking at Jeremy Reagan. Just a couple of online crime buffs who think they've got it all figured out. So they just went ahead and named names and named Jeremy Reagan. Jeremy Reagan is live with me tonight. Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on with me tonight. How has your life changed since the online army came after you?
It's definitely been weird. I've had a lot of people online just sort of saying, well, this wouldn't have happened if you never did an interview. If you wouldn't have done X, Y, and Z during the interviews, then we wouldn't have been suspicious of you. But it's not like I was intentionally doing anything during the interview or like I had sought out these interviews. Every single time I've done one, it's been either the reporter or someone with the reporter asking me to do these. But people online have just been ruthless. They went through and gone through all of my social media history over the past decade, just trying to find anything and everything they can about me, pulling up Facebook posts from my mom from a decade ago saying, oh, he was a hunter back in 2012. He must have done it. Just because a psychic had done a reading and said that it was probably a hunter, even though almost everyone in Idaho hunts at some point. And so they've just been digging into anything and everything they can find about my personal life and trying to somehow link it back to this.
So let's clear the air for anybody who's watching tonight and maybe still even has suspicions. So some of them said he refused to give his DNA to the police. Have the police ever come in contact with you or asked you for DNA or had any requests like that?
Earlier today actually was the first time. Before this, they hadn't interviewed me other than that first day, a couple hours after the news broke that there was a killing there. But up until earlier today, I hadn't been contacted by the police. But then today, partly because of all the reports that people had sent in about me and the interview I did, as well as me going and talking with one of the local prosecutors about what I can do to clear my name, the officers came by my house today. They talked with me. They interviewed me. They didn't bring anything to collect DNA today, but they said if we need you, will you come down to the station? I said, absolutely. And so if they give me another call, or if they don't call me within a few days, I'll probably go down anyways. But
To be clear, you reached out to the prosecutor as well. Let's be really clear about that. So it's just absolutely an abject lie that you refused to give DNA. You've spoken to them. You've offered it. They've said they'll come back and ask you for it. They certainly don't seem to think it's a big panic. And then the other question for the record, where were you when the murders occurred?
I was in my bed. I went to sleep roughly at 11:30 that night, woke up somewhere between 8 and 9 o'clock the next morning. And so I was just in my house, in my bed.
So I heard in an interview at some point you gave that you said you now carry a weapon. I have two questions about that. What kind of weapon do you carry? And then second, is it because you fear the killer that's out there, or fear the trolls that are coming after you?
It's a gun. It's just a handgun. And it's not really that I fear for anything. It's just I feel safer having it. I don't walk around thinking maybe the killer's going to come for me next, stab me in the back or something like that. But just having it on me gives me that extra sense of security, especially now where cyber sleuths may or may not come. They've already contacted my friends asking questions about me. And so who knows if someone's going to go so far as to try and confront me in person, even though I've on Reddit specifically, I've gone through and posted and answered questions that people had. But you never know if someone's going to try and come talk to me personally or come try anything in real life. So
sure,
I just feel safer having it generally.
We've seen people show up at murder scenes before who are not involved in any way in the story. I have one last question for you. I've got about 15 seconds left. Did you know the girls, or had you ever been in the house?
I didn't know them, and I'd never been to the house. I'd been up to the front door because I had found a lost phone last semester. So I went and knocked on the door, asked if they knew whose it was. The girl that answered said no. So I left and went to the next house. Did the same thing until I was finally able to figure out whose phone it was. That's the only time I was at the house. But I was never actually inside.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the air and clearing up a lot of these misconceptions that have been online. I'm sorry that you're going through this, Jeremy, but keep us posted on what happens. If the police do come back, you know, give us a heads up, and we'll talk about, you know, what happens from here. Thanks for doing this tonight.
Yep, no problem. Thank you.
Jeremy. All right, thank you, Chris Cuomo. And Brian Enten is back with me. Brian, I have a couple of questions, and I'm going to start with one question. And as you show me the answer, I'm going to launch into the second question. The first one comes from Chanel732 on Twitter, who asks this: is there an officer watching the backside of the house where you are tonight? And I don't know if you've got the freedom to show us around, but if you can, get on the move. And I'm going to ask you the second question while you're able to show us. Or are you there right now? Are you at the back?
Yeah, I'll show you real quick. This is the front. You can see the police officer, and I'm going to walk you to the back. If you want to go to the second question, we'll walk to the back.
Yeah, the second question is from Blink Twice for me on Twitter, and that person says, I saw police canine at the scene, but I haven't seen any news indicating what a dog was used for. Was a dog used at all to try to track where the killer went when he left the house, which is, you know, another good reason to be walking to the back of the house where you are.
Okay, first of all, let me show you. This is the back of the house. They've got the crime scene tape up here, but there is no police guard or police car guarding anything. And by the way, there's this big parking lot back here, which I found interesting the whole time we've been here, that this exists right behind the house. As far as the canine, the dog, I haven't seen any dogs out here early on. They may have used a dog to try to track someone in the backyard here, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, this next question comes from Dylan on Twitter. If there's been $1 million provided in the efforts to solve this crime, that came from the state, why has no reward money been offered? Why would they wait, or would they wait for any DNA lab results to come back with no matches and then announce a reward for information? At what point do they decide to announce a reward in a case?
Good question. I asked the police that today. They said they're still getting a lot of tips right now, so they don't feel the need for a reward. But if things slow down and they don't make progress, a reward could be coming in the future.
Okay, this next one is from Still Believe in Hope on Twitter. And they ask regarding social media. It's a good question considering our last segment. What is the law with regard to social media? Can the FBI get information from Meta, Instagram, Snapchat, which IP addresses looked at the last few photos or posts before the murders? Meaning, users can't see if someone visits a page or looks at a picture, but Meta can. IPs that stalked their pages.
I think it's possible. You would know better than me, Ashley, but I would think they would need a subpoena, correct, in a situation like that?
Yes. Very often, and early sort of in the digital revolution, it was very, very difficult even to get passwords from like Apple to open a phone in a criminal investigation. But they've sorted through a lot of that. And a subpoena usually does the trick. And there is more information than you can imagine on a digital popcorn trail. All right. So, Brian, stay with me because after the break, we're going to answer that that question that left us chilled. What evidence could have been lost in that winter weather? That's next. Brian Enten is back answering your questions. And Brian, winter hit Moscow, Idaho with a vengeance yesterday, and that actually could be important to the case. This next question comes from David. Have a listen.
Hi, Brian. My name is David from Florida. My question is this. Do you think the cold weather presents a challenge to this investigation, especially when collecting footprints, given that the ground was frozen, or the below freezing temperatures overnight for collecting DNA evidence outside the house?
Hey, Brian, how about just the fact that it snowed so much and you said it's going to snow more?
Yeah, 6 inches of snow coming, a lot of snow in the forecast. I mean, surely it's not a good thing if they want to check something out outside the house again. It's all now been covered by snow. But I would imagine most of the work that they did on the outside was done early on. And now they just have this perimeter mainly to preserve the inside of the building.
I mean, let's hope, because that perimeter got bigger and then it never again did get small. And then the snow, you know, covered everything. So, Brian, thank you for all of that. You did such a great job tonight. Really appreciate it. Let's meet right back here again tomorrow night. Can you?
You got it, Ashley.
All right. Thank you, Brian. And that is it for us tonight, folks. But tomorrow, there is that vigil that's going to be held for the murdered students. And it is entirely possible, people, that the killer could show up at that vigil. So we're actually going to talk to a behavioralist about what police might actually be looking for in the crowd. Think about Scott Peterson. Scott Peterson went to Lacey Peterson's vigil and he's on death row for it. So actually getting cleared. But so we're going to be very, astute to that particular angle of the story tomorrow night. And then also up next on Cuomo, striking railroad workers. President Biden wants Congress to step in, but what does that mean for his union allies? And what does it mean for the busy holiday season and all those goods that need to move about the country and into your home and under your tree? It is all straight ahead on Cuomo, and I'll see you here tomorrow night.